Welcome to the December 2015 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan or This Month and Other Journals besides the AJNR. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 8 articles from the recent literature I've found of interest, and I hope you find them of some interest as well. Per usual, the references that I am discussing will all be posted onto the AJNR blog for your convenience. The first paper has the first author of Hunzinga, and it's entitled Innate Immunity to Campylobacter jejuni in Guillain-Barré Syndrome. This is from Annals of Neurology from 2015. Guillain-Barré syndrome is an acute antibody-mediated polyneuropathy that occurs shortly after common infections, such as Campylobacter jejuni. 1 in 3 to 5,000 symptomatic infections will be followed by the development of Guillain-Barré. The production of Guillain-Barré syndrome requires sialation of lipooligosaccharides, which leads to molecular mimicry with human neural gangliosides. Nevertheless, half of the strains of Campylobacter jejuni with uncomplicated gastroenteritis also express sialated lipooligosaccharides. So other factors must be involved in its production. In this paper, the authors evaluated the intrinsic responsiveness of dendritic cells, which is a type of myeloid cell, to Campylobacter jejuni through toll-like receptor 4 activation. And there are signaling pathways between toll-like receptor 4 and the production of type 1 interferon. Through a bunch of biochemistry that I don't understand, the authors conclude that former Guillain-Barré patients exhibit increased dendritic cell responsiveness to Campylobacter jejuni lipooligosaccharides. The extent of CD38 and CD40 expression on dendritic cells was significantly correlated with residual disability. High innate responsiveness to Campylobacter jejuni lipooligosaccharides through the toll-like receptor 4 seems to be a prerequisite for development of Guillain-Barré syndrome after an infection with Campylobacter jejuni. Let's go on to the second paper, which has a first author of Mooney, and it is entitled Long-Term Patient Outcomes After Microsurgical Treatment of Blister-Like Aneurysms of the Basilar Artery. This is from Neurosurgery from 2015. Blister-like aneurysms are small, hemisphere-shaped defects that arise from non-branching points of the cerebral arteries and are associated with high risk of rupture. They are formed by a platelet plug covering a thin layer of adventitia, which overlies a defect in the intima and media. They are thought to be secondary to a variety of things, such as atherosclerosis, hemodynamic stress, dissections, or a combination of all these factors. Most occur in the anterior circulation, and the basilar artery blister-like aneurysms are a small subset. The authors treated 4 patients with blister-like aneurysms with a mean age of 52 years, and a mean size of the base of the aneurysm of just over 2 millimeters. All were located at non-branching points of the basilar, and all the patients presented with subarachnoid hemorrhage. In 3 patients, the aneurysms were treated using a microsurgical technique, and in 1 patient, a combined microsurgical and endovascular approach was used. In the baroruptured aneurysm trial, patients with basilar trunk or basilar tip aneurysms made up about 5% of the group, which was 22 of 408 cases, of the cases of ruptured aneurysms enrolled in that study. Blister-like aneurysms of the basilar artery thus are a rare subset of the basilar artery aneurysms, and over the 7-year study period at their institution, only 4 patients were encountered. There are 2 figures with this paper. Figure 1 is artwork of the clip and stent approaches to the different patients' treatment. Let's go on to the third paper, which has a first author of Wang, and it's entitled Effect of Clopidogrel with Aspirin on Functional Outcome in TIA or Minor Stroke, the Chance Substudy. This is from Neurology in 2015. The authors compared the effect of clopidogrel plus aspirin versus aspirin alone on the functional outcome and quality of life after acute minor stroke or TIA. Participants were assessed at 90 days for functional outcome using the modified Rankin scale and quality of life using the EQ-5D. Poor functional outcomes occurred in 254 patients, about 10%, in the clopidogrel aspirin group, as it compared with 299 patients, a little over 11%, in the aspirin group. Disabling stroke at 90 days occurred in 6.5% in the clopidogrel aspirin group and in 8.5% in the aspirin group. So they conclude that the study provides class 2 evidence for patients with acute minor stroke or TIA. Clopidogrel plus aspirin compared to aspirin alone improves 90-day functional outcome. The authors note in the discussion that the rate of disability or death at 90 days was high, and clopidogrel was associated with a 1.7% absolute reduction of poor functional outcome, which was equivalent to a number needed to treat of 59 patients to prevent a functional disability. They note that the ongoing triple antiplatelets for reducing dependency after ischemic stroke, that's the TARDIS trial, will determine whether triple antiplatelet strategy will be superior to dual antiplatelet therapy. All right, let's go on to paper number 4, first author of Finson. This is LMNB1-related autosomal dominant leukodystrophy, clinical and radiological course. This is from Annals of Neurology from 2015. Duplication of the LMNB1 gene encoding lamin B1 causes adult-onset autosomal dominant leukodystrophy, starting with autonomic symptoms which are followed by pyramidal signs and ataxia. The authors describe the first longitudinal study of this disease in 23 subjects in two families over two decades. Signal intensity abnormalities started with small T2 hyperintensities under the motor cortex and extended downward through the pyramidal tracts, affecting the cerebral and cerebellar peduncles and pyramids, even in subjects who were still asymptomatic. With increasing disease duration, T2 hyperintensities became more widespread and confluent throughout the cerebral white matter, affecting the cerebral lobes in the order frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal. Most subjects over the age of 40 years had widespread signal changes in the white matter. The periventricular white matter was less affected. All subjects, even asymptomatic ones, exhibited abnormal T2 signal in the white matter of the spinal cord. So in the end, this is one more thing to add to my weird differential for bilateral middle cerebellar peduncle signal abnormality, such as fragile X premutation tremor ataxia syndrome. So we're going to put LMNB1-related autosomal dominant leukodystrophy. This paper has 10 figures total, including 6 MRIs and 36 references. All right, onward to paper number 5. This has a first author of Sugawara, and it is entitled Medially Misplaced Pedicle Screws in Patients Without Neurological Deficits Following Scoliosis Surgery, to Observe or to Remove. And this is from the European Spine Journal. The authors investigated whether pedicle screws medially misplaced into the spinal canal without neurological complications should be removed or not. 86 patients with scoliosis that underwent spinal fusion using 988 pedicle screws were retrospectively reviewed after a minimum follow-up of 2 years. Medial perforations were evaluated using immediate postoperative helical CT images and classified into 3 grades. Grade 1 was 0 to 2 millimeters, grade 2 was 2 to 4 millimeters, and grade 3 was over 4 millimeters. CSF leakage from screw holes were recognized in 3 of 87 medially misplaced screws. That was about 3.5%. They conclude that screws medially misplaced at a distance greater than 2 millimeters, and especially the 4 millimeter, which makes sense, may be a cause of negative effects on the neural structure and should be removed during early phase of postoperative period, even in the face of no neurological abnormalities. The incidence of pedicle screw malposition in thoracic pedicles in the treatment of spinal deformities ranges from about 3 to 25%, and screw-related neurological complications much lower, in the range of 0 to 0.9%. Let's go on. Paper number 6, first author of Kalani, and it is entitled Pineal Cyst Resection in the Absence of Ventriculomegaly, or Paranoid's Syndrome, Clinical Outcomes and Implications for Patient Selection. This is from Journal of Neurosurgery in 2015. Surgical indications for patients with pineal cysts remain controversial. The majority of patients with a pineal cyst require no treatment. Still, surgery is a well-accepted option for the subset of patients with secondary hydrocephalus or Paranoid syndrome. The authors retrospectively reviewed the records and imaging of patients surgically treated between 2001 and 2014 with pineal cyst in the absence of ventriculomegaly or Paranoid syndrome. There were 18 patients, 14 female, 4 male, mean age of 24 years, and they underwent cyst resection in the absence of those two symptoms. Presenting symptoms included headache in 17, visual disturbance in 10 patients, gait instability, 5 patients, dizziness, 5 patients, episodic loss of consciousness, 2 patients, and hypersomnolence, 1 patient. At a mean clinical follow-up of 19 months, 94% of the patients had symptom resolution or improvement. They conclude that ventriculomegaly and paranoids are not absolute requisites for a pineal cyst to be symptomatic. I never know quite what to do with these type of results. The wide variation in symptoms that were treated I find confusing, so I guess anything can somehow be related to a pineal cyst. I wonder how this group would have done with a sham procedure a la the vertebroplasty results. Let's go on to paper number 7. First author of De Cruz, it is entitled Elective versus Therapeutic Neck Dissection in Node-Negative Oral Cancer, and this is from the New England Journal of Medicine from 2015. The authors evaluated 596 patients in a prospective, randomized, controlled trial evaluating the effect on survival of elective node dissection, ipsilateral neck dissection at the time of primary surgery, versus therapeutic node dissection, which was watchful waiting followed by neck dissection for nodal relapse, in patients with lateralized stage T1 or T2 oral squamous cell carcinomas. There were 81 recurrences and 50 deaths in the elective surgery group, and 146 recurrences and 79 deaths in the therapeutic surgery group. At 3 years, elective node dissection resulted in an improved rate of overall survival. They conclude that with early stage oral squamous cell cancer, elective neck dissection resulted in higher rates of overall and disease-free survival than did therapeutic neck dissection. The authors note in the discussion that the results show an absolute overall survival benefit of 12.5 percentage points and a disease-free survival benefit of 23.6 percentage points. So that translates into 8 patients would be needed to be treated with an elective neck dissection to prevent 1 death, and 4 patients treated to prevent 1 relapse. And number 8, the final paper for this month, is first author of Goni, and it is entitled Efficacy of Epidural Perineural Injection of Autologous Conditioned Serum in Unilateral Cervical Radiculopathy. This is from Spine in 2015. The authors studied the efficacy of epidural perineural injection of autologous conditioned serum versus methylprednisolone in 40 unilateral cervical radiculopathy patients. Patients were equally allocated into autologous conditioned serum and steroid groups and were injected with 2.5 to 3 cc's of autologous conditioned serum or steroid, respectively, under image guidance into the perineural area of the affected nerve root. Patients who had received injections of the conditioned serum and steroids both had improvements in the scores of evaluation tools. They conclude that the conditioned serum can be considered an equally good or better modality of non-operative management in patients of unilateral cervical radiculopathy as steroid. Well, this is not exactly a resounding endorsement for autologous conditioned serum. Like that other paper, I wonder what the group would do, you know, if they had an injected saline only as a control group. Check out figure 3, which shows placement of the needle on an oblique fluoroscopy spot film, plus a view of the operator's fingers. Now, I've taken many pictures, unfortunately, with my hands in the fluorotube, but I don't think I've ever published one with my fingers in there. Well, that's all for this month. I hope you found some interest in that group of articles. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. If you have feedback on the podcast, just email me with your criticism or hopefully praise at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. Till next time, thank you so much for listening.